Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. Sorry, we're a little late. Just packing things into packets was a little bit overwhelming. Okay, let's go. We'll start with Representative Lynn Carlson with House File 2577.
Madam Chair, Representative Serge and I were joking about who might end up going first, and apparently I won the toss or whatever. Which House file did you say? I've got three.
25 was doing the whichever one you want, but we were starting with the legislature calling a special session.
Special session, okay.
Okay, so that's House File 2577, and I will move that House File 2577 be recommended to pass and go to finance. Representative Carlson.
And Madam Chair, I do have an amendment that I think has been distributed, and maybe we could put that amendment on it, but put the bill in the order I would like. You should have received a copy earlier today.
Yes, it is in our packet.
Okay. I'm ex officio on your committee, so I can't move these.
I know. Okay, I'll move the A1 amendment.
And
why don't you explain the amendment?
Yeah, and the amendment, Madam Chair, simply clarifies the length of a special session. And we had, that was an amendment that was put on in an earlier committee. And we just needed to clarify the language so that, bottom line, what we're doing on 2.4 is instead of putting in the word require, it's allow.
Okay.
And then on 2.5, inserted the word legislative, so it's clear that it's 7 legislative days is what
okay.
be the maximum length that you could have a
okay.
special session.
Well, this is the form in which the author wants his bill, so all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay. Yeah, Madam Chair, this bill would allow the legislature to call a special session, and the reason for the bill is that it would provide more balance between the branches of government. It would provide for more transparency. It would hopefully eliminate gridlock, and it allows the legislature to act promptly if we were in need of dealing with a disaster, and it simply provides more flexibility. Under this proposal, the legislature would need the agreement of the presiding officers in both bodies and approval by the committees with jurisdiction over the rules in each body to call a special session. Currently, legislatures in 33 other states have this capability, including neighboring states, Iowa and Wisconsin, and another Midwestern state, Missouri. In the vast majority of these states, the legislature rarely calls a special session. However, the ability of the state legislature to call a special session would provide a balance between the branches of government and reduce the gridlock that results when governing bodies do not agree. In the last few years, there have been several ongoing debates that have warranted calling a special session. After the 2007 session, the critical need for a comprehensive transportation bill was before us, and the need to pass a tax bill to provide property tax relief. In addition, this change would have allowed the legislature to respond quickly, or would allow, into catastrophic events, and a couple of recent examples when the I-35 bridge collapsed and the floods hit southeastern Minnesota. There was ongoing confusion about whether or when the governor would call a special session to address these crises. At times such as these, any delay is costly, and the legislature was ready to act and was not able to do so until the governor actually called the special session. Finally, the bill allows for additional transparency and flexibility in the process by limiting the number of legislative days to 7. It allows enough time for the public to be able to participate and the flexibility to shape legislation based on that dialogue while at the same time ensuring these issues are resolved in a timely manner. It is important to note that the legislature already has authority, interestingly enough, to call a special session in the event of an attack on the state if the governor does not call one within 30 days. Until I got into this issue, I didn't realize that there were any circumstances where a special session could be called by the legislature. Representative Kahn, you might be interested in knowing, there's the Legislative Society retired members and so on. You and I are both members. They're not retired. They're active members now and retired, mainly retired, gray-haired group is what they sometimes refer to themselves as. They asked me for suggestions of bills they might debate when they had their mock legislative session, and they do that every year. And this was one that I suggested, and it did pass before that group with a rather strong vote, and it was bipartisan.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, just a couple of quick things. You have a handout that lists the states and the circumstances under which they can call a special session. You also have a handout that shows the frequency with which special sessions are called by the legislature, as well as those called by the governor. You also have a letter from the League of Women Voters, and it's my understanding that they're going to be testifying on the other bill. Okay. They'll be testifying on the other bill, but there was a favorable editorial a couple of years ago when I raised this issue in the Tribune and the Bemidji Pioneer. So with that, Madam Chair, I will stop and be willing to take questions.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Carlson, you talked several times about gridlock, and of course that's something we all want to work on. I guess my concern is that this could lead to more special sessions, and that's one concern. I have another concern about the constitutional separation of powers that we've relied upon since we've been a state. And then my other concern is that if we're going to go this route, why would we not have the minority leaders included from the House and the Senate, because then you just have one party deciding when we're having a special session.
Madam Chair, under the language that's before you, it would be the legislative leadership, but they would have to bring that to the committees that have jurisdiction over rules, and as you know, both parties are represented on the Rules Committee.
Representative Pepin.
Yes, but that party is the same party of the control of the House or Senate, so it would be, again, one party. If it's no matter who's in charge, if it was the Republicans that were in charge, then it would be the Republicans would be in charge of the Rules Committee as well. So this is just leads to a one-party control, at least under current circumstances.
Yeah. Well,
I don't have any further response other than before the Rules Committee, both parties are represented, and beyond that, you asked about separation of powers as well, and I think that from my perspective, that enhances that role because it enhances the role of the legislature. But I would like to point out when you talk or were concerned about, if you look at the one handout there in terms of the frequency of special sessions called by the legislature in other states, you will see that it is not frequently used. The most extreme case with special sessions happened to be Arizona, 32 of which were called between 1990 and 2000 by the governor and none by the legislature, even though the legislature was authorized. Probably a bit more mainstream would be the next one on the list, Delaware was six by the governor. There were three that happened to be called by the legislature. You'll notice that there were several states where they were called by the governor and none were called by the legislature. I think in part, if you were to sit down and negotiate with the governor of a given state, what probably happens is that there's a pretty good dialogue between the executive and the legislative branch. and in the end, perhaps the governor does end up calling the special session, knowing that the legislature would have that authority if the governor did not. But it's not frequently used anywhere in the country, that even among the 32 states that have the authority.
Madam Chair?
Representative Pepin.
So would you consider putting in the minority, or what would be the point of not including the minority? Or at least not having a, you know, a supermajority on the floor or something like that, where it truly would be a bipartisan effort, at least, even though, in my opinion, it still would be unconstitutional, but...
I think that runs the risk, Madam Chair, of legislative gridlock, potentially. I would prefer that the majority party, even if it was your party, if you were in control, that you have that authority. I would like to have a system where we would have input through our membership on the Rules Committee if we were in the minority. But you do have to sometimes arrive at a decision, and it would be easier to arrive at that decision if you had system where the majority party was able to make that decision. The other thing, much of my time here, you know, the Senate has been under the control of the Democrats for literally my entire time here, mm-hmm. which is now 38 years. The House has gone back and forth, so you do have some checks and balances within the legislative body, and there have been many years when the executive has been controlled by a party, or well, I guess I'd say a party other than ours, because there was Ventura, but then we've had Republican and Democratic governors during my time.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's my point. There isn't any balance in the Senate. It has been the Senate. The Democrats have been in charge in the Senate since I was born, so there would never, this would only work to the advantage of one party. And I think, you know, I'm not sure if the people, if they had a constitutional amendment, would be able to understand the full consequences of just reading a few sentences, but to me, this is a lot like what's going on in Congress right now, using some really procedural moves to bypass the legislative process. And I think that the public would be very cynical, and I think this would do the exact opposite of what your intention would be. I think this would create more partisanship and more gridlock than ever before. And also, I noticed that there's not any information as to how many times the legislature could be in session, so potentially we could be in session all year long. You could keep calling special sessions.
Madam Chair, I think on that point, public opinion would probably weigh in if it would appear that it was being abused. But you would have, for any given session, 7 legislative days. I was here at one time when both of us were, Governor Cui had 6 special sessions called by the governor. So if that's a problem, it can be a problem under the current system as well. But most of our time here, I think, represented on the special sessions have not been overused. It's usually to deal with a crisis situation of some sort.
Okay. Representative Kerr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess mine is just in response to Representative Pepin, that I don't think it is trying to cater to one particular party. It's just making a statement that whoever is the majority in the Senate and then the House, and we can't make that call from, you know, session to, or term to term, who that's going to be, who would be calling that. And there could be split within that, or it could be one side versus the other. But I think, Representative Carlson, you've answered my question about why you did not go with a supermajority. But if you could just, you know, and I came in a little late, and I'm sorry for that, but I guess I would like to know, why did you choose not to have any votes by membership of either of the bodies?
We did have language where you could do it by petition, and I've been actually I've been working on this for the last 4 years, where we did have a system where members could petition for a special session, and the Senate preferred the language when we were working with them that it be done through the Rules Committee. So that was a concession, I guess, on our part that that system be used rather than a petition. But there are some states that do have a petition. It can be used.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I am not a lawyer nor a constitutional scholar, but some clarification would be really helpful for me. My immediate bias on this is against it. I I don't know why we would want to grant the legislature, I'll say, a carte blanche authority to take up bills at any point of time throughout the year. It seems like the Constitution, as it was written, built in some constraints in terms of our adjournment period, the number of legislative days. And I assume there was wisdom in that, and there was intention in that. And the language, current language in the Constitution, says that the governor can call the legislature into special session, but constrained by extraordinary occasions. And I don't see anything like that. I don't see extraordinary occasions in the prerogative of the legislature to call a special session. So maybe a question for the author or anybody else in terms of why wouldn't we also limit the legislative authority to call a special session to extraordinary occasions? And then maybe secondly, would this not be interpreted to somehow be, frankly, in contrast or contradiction to the original intent, which seems to be in a very intentional check and balance on the legislature, that this power was granted to the governor only intentionally to provide a check on the power? So maybe those two questions, why on any occasion for the legislature, but only on extraordinary occasions for the governor, and how is this not somehow maybe in violation of the original intent of the current provision?
It would be pure speculation on my part to know what the original intent may have been. I think in part my answer to that question is that there are 33 states that did choose to do it differently and did choose to empower the legislature. I always find it rather interesting when legislators are concerned about having a greater opportunity for input as representatives of this branch. I would think that that would be something that most of us would be quite interested in, and that's to maintain and have a good balance of power between the executive and the legislative branch. That's where I come at it from. And by the way, this is when I mentioned 4 years, Madam Chair, this is not a new issue from my perspective. I first raised this question in the early 80s, and it's an issue that I think the League of Women Voters has indicated goes back. They've had it as a goal since about 1955 or something like that. I think you've got a letter from them in your packet.
Representative Downey, if I can speculate, I believe that the current legislative session was set so that people could get their crops in. And that was prior to global warming. After global warming, they might have had it end up. Had global warming had been thought of at that time, they might have had it end a month earlier or 2 weeks earlier, whatever the effect is.
And Madam Chair, you and I came in the first time after a constitutional amendment was passed establishing annual sessions. So there have been changes. I mean, I don't think that we have to necessarily be locked into what was originally crafted as the Constitution.
And obviously this will not pass unless it's acceptable to the public. So I think we don't have to speculate before we put it on as to whether it is or not. Representative Downey, you want to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Many of us appreciate the two-year cycle and might even enjoy going back to that, and appreciate that maybe the less we do, the better down here. But I guess one question I asked, I'm not sure if you answered it, but so why not constrain the legislature to extraordinary occasions similarly to the governor in the current provision?
Madam Chair, that's a bit in the eye of the beholder. I think that would be one of the responses. I think as a practical matter, virtually every special session that I've participated in, there have been particular problems that needed to be addressed.
Representative Browning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize, I'm a little bit late. Are we actually voting this through committee today?
I think so.
And at the point that you're ready for amendments, actually, I would offer an oral amendment, but I'll wait for further discussion until we're to that point.
Well, I don't, is there anyone? Who else? Representative Bigham.
No, I'll pass on my snide comment.
Okay.
I was going to make.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. My question has to do with the 7 legislative days, and would you think that it would still allow for the legislature by joint resolution to adjourn for more than 3 days at a time? In other words, instead of saying 7 legislative days, under your proposal, could the legislature adjourn for, say, a month and then come back for a day? In other words, could a special session be dragged out over a long period of time through joint resolution for breaks of longer than 3 days?
You're the first to ask that question, but my assumption is theoretically you probably could, but that's not been the history of special sessions. I suspect if there were, for some reason, a special session called just before, let's say, the 4th of July or something, and you were within that 7 days, there might be a necessity to do that. I think in all likelihood what would happen is that you'd have an opportunity within that 7 days. And remember, one of the things that my goals is transparency. You'd have the special session. You'd have a chance for proposals to be made, for the public to weigh in and go through the process.
Right, but I mean,
but I think you could, I don't think that would be bad if there were circumstances where you wanted to adjourn for 3 additional days.
Well, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Mr. Carlson, or Representative Carlson, this, I don't really care about what you suppose. I'm trying to figure out worst-case scenario here, and if you've changed this to legislative days, there's no constraint on the amount of time that you could break, so this conceivably could be dragged out for quite a while. And it really doesn't matter, because the way it's set up, even if you had to adjourn because you used up your 7 days over a couple months period of time, the presiding officers could just re-up again anyway, so it's really not a huge deal. This could go on for quite a while, but my other question has to do with the status of committees, and I don't know if it's dictated by rule or by statute, but at least in some years when we sign a die, the committees no longer exist. Well, how does in that second year, I don't know if this is a research question, or I mean, I know we've met, but we haven't been an official committee and we haven't conducted any business, official business or vote. So after sign die, what is the status of committees in Senate?
Madam Chair, maybe research can respond to that, but it's my understanding that the standing committees remain as functioning committees even after we adjourn sine die. Many of them have met and so on during the interim. They continue to meet. Maybe it's more traditional. I guess I would defer that to council if they have an answer.
Madam Chair, my recollection is that we meet in between the two sessions and they continue to function, but once we sign a die, they do not.
Well, that I know that there are certain times when they had, for example, I know that the commissions have. I know that the Pension Commission has sometimes continued meeting.
I'm looking if somebody can give me the answer to that, in that it requires, his bill also requires that it, the committee with jurisdiction over rules has to agree to this as well, and do they continue to function after sine die, I guess is my question.
Madam Chair, I've served on the Rules Committee, and the chair of the Rules Committee just happens to be sitting behind us, but remember, that's Rules and Legislative Administration, and the Rules Committee continues to function through the entire biennium, whether we've adjourned sine die or not. They are responsible for the administration of the House, and we do meet during that period. And I think my take on it would be that, but I would, for the rest of the committees, I know I've chaired a number of committees through the years, and We don't meet frequently because people are busy often with elections and so on, but there are times when the standing committees meet during that period. Our budget continues on through December 31st of that year, so I'm fairly confident, the more I think about it, that those standing committees still continue to function.
I think Mr. Shepherd might have some opinion.
Madam Chair, members, yes, I believe what Representative Carlson said is correct. There is a statute which I think was enacted even before there were annual sessions that provides that each standing committee of the Senate and the House is continued during the intervals between sessions of the legislature. And so I think it is true that the committees would have authority, if they wanted to meet after sine die adjournment.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shepherd, could you clarify, do the committees then have the authority to vote or take action on legislation? Because I've been to various committee hearings during interim, and I don't recall ever taking a vote.
Madam Chair and Representative Pepin, I think it's been the custom of the House that committees don't vote on legislation during interim because there would be impossible to report the legislation back to the full House until the session came back. But I believe that the Rules Committee has taken official action after sine die adjournment in the form of resolutions that would affect the, for example, the internal business of the House or other things.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Representative Winkler?
I think I saw in the packet here that this bill has a zero fiscal note.
Yeah.
And I've had the considerable, Representative Pepin shaking her head, but I don't, the one that I read said zero. And having had the full benefit of a discussion on the operational aspects of this and the Government Operations Committee, I wonder what were the particular focus of our discussion is today.
Well, our focus is clearly only on the fiscal the fiscal costs of this, but it's always a good idea to find out what we're looking at before we look at it. But we do, and we've never anyway, we do have the fiscal impact, and I guess we go, the issue is that there is always a cost. It is a constitutional amendment, so there always is a cost of putting a constitutional amendment on the ballot.
Yeah,
you want to speak?
Madam Chair, I've heard that the number is relatively low, and that's... the history of constitutional amendments that's been absorbed by the Secretary of State's office, whether it's in the base when periodically there's a constitutional amendment. It's very minimal. It's just the added line on the ballot, and I would say that it's in their base funding, or they're just simply asked to do that.
Yep. Representative Kipfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did note, though, maybe to the state that's okay, but when you take a look at the cost to the counties, that is not the case. And I think we should make sure that we take a look at the fiscal implications here in regards to the counties. It's only maybe a, quote, zero to the state, but that doesn't mean there's no cost here to entities that need to implement this, putting it on the ballot. I believe that's $102,000 is the estimated county cost.
Of course, that gets divided among 87 counties. Probably not equivalently divided for all of them, but
Madam Chair, right now, you know, you do 1,000 here to the counties, 10,000 there. You take away this and you take away that, and so I think it all kind of adds up. It isn't the basis of 87 divided into 102,000. It's all the other ones as well.
Okay. Well, I guess this committee, you know, this is information that's before us about the local government costs. We don't have to appropriate for it, and it's just, I think it's just here for information. So, yes, you could vote against it if that's the reason for concern.
And, Madam Chair, to this point, Representative Carlson, have you heard from the county auditors any objection to and local election folks to having this on the ballot?
No, I haven't heard anything from local units at all.
Have you asked?
Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I'm going to make some comments that I hope will ease some of the concerns. If I'm wrong, you can correct me. But I would say in the last 20, 30 years, whenever there's been special sessions, both the governor and the legislature have suffered. So I'm thinking, no matter who's in charge, calling a special session is an incredibly dangerous thing to do. However, after the collapse of 35W and the flood in southern Minnesota, I think there were a lot of people that expected the legislature to meet after those and were very concerned when we took, after one we didn't, the other it took a long time. And I think there were some hard feelings because we weren't in session.
Okay. Representative Downing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a quick comment and to expand on this a little bit. I mean, right now, sine die means something, and the legislature has a very hard stop in terms of it having to conduct its business. And I would look at this, at least certainly currently as written, as just an opportunity to push the deadline back, and just like any other project where you got a movable final date, you know what, people just push things off and always rely on the movable date. So again, I'm not in favor of this thing in principle, but just another observation in that if you go back to page 6 on the fiscal note, it actually does project the cost, the actual costs, and there's some assumptions here about calling a special session in for one day in both FY11 and FY13. I don't, maybe that's a good or isn't a good planning assumption, but it is there, and I don't know, maybe that's all built into the target. So maybe that's the specific question to Representative Carlson, is if we is the fiscal note built into the targets that we currently have before this committee? Well, and the other bills,
but the issue is that we certainly would not, we build it in that we have a certain amount of legislative carry forward money to carry out the constitutional duties of the legislature, but this would have to be passed first, by put on the ballot. Has a long way to go before we would want to do a hard fiscal cost on this. The only real decision is the cost of putting it on the ballot at this point. Representative Pepin, you know, we are supposed to, I don't want to cut things off too quickly, but we are supposed to only look at the fiscal impacts of this. This has been passed by a committee to us, so, but it is before us, so.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. I was just wondering, since under current law, I believe the governor can call a special session, but only the legislature can close down a special session. And I'm wondering if you had given any thought to perhaps to somehow balance out the power to do something similar, either let the governor end special session or change the statute, the current statute, to allow the governor to close down session after 7 days to make it a little bit more of a balance of power.
It's interesting, Madam Chair, the way you say that, the governor closed it down after 7 days. The amendment would allow that we'd have to close it down already after we had expired the 7 days authorized in the amendment. So I don't think that would be needed.
Well, it would be, Madam Chair, for the other part, because right now the governor can't close down the special session, and that still would be in statute. So if he were to call a special session, then what authority would he have to? Would he then, if he called a special session, then this, it would only last for 7 days as well?
No.
For, Madam Chair, so we're not changing the authority of the governor at all, and all the other checks and balances would be in place if the legislature did something that the governor was opposed to. The governor would have the opportunity to choose to veto. I mean, all of it. The only thing we're doing is allowing the legislature to come in for a special session for 7 legislative days, and that's the limitation. And if the 7 days, going back to what your original comment was, were to be used, the legislature would have to adjourn.
So, okay. Any further? Representative Downey, do you want an amendment or not?
Madam Chair, I'll, if I'll probably be ruled non-germane if we're only dealing with the fiscal components of it.
We don't rule
I'll save it. I'll pass on my amendment. And
We don't rule things non-germane in committee.
Oh, okay.
Well, Representative Lane did the other day.
What?
Representative Lane did rule something non-germane in committee the other day.
All right. A more liberal approach. Okay. All right. Okay. Any other comment on the bill? And I guess it just goes back to finance.
To finance.
We'll get a friendly reset as amended. Or I assume it gets a friendly reset.
I think it gets a hearing there.
Okay. Okay. All those in favor of the motion to pass the bill on to finance as amended? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion passes. Okay. Do the next call thing. Okay. Let's do the. Oh, why don't we do the other call? Let's do the second call. You don't object, Representative?
No, I have okay. No problem with that. I've got a 3-0.
Okay. 2-8-6-6. No, whoa! We want you. We just yes.
Yeah.
2-8-6-6. No, no. We're asking him, making sure it's okay with him, and then we'll put.
Oh,
you.
And if it's okay with you, well, thank the majority leader for.
No one has.
For doing that, I was open to either process you wanted to use. Which one do you want to take next?
2-8-6-6.
Okay, that's the.
Does he have more?
Oh, wait, here. Okay. Three bills. I've got three files here. Okay. I got to make sure I've got the right file. Madam Chair, this. Is a bill that deals with the unallotment question. And just to walk you through the bill and give you a little background, and as all of you know, the question of unallotment has been something that's been talked about quite a lot since last June. The unallotment statute...
Let me move the bill so it's before us. House file 2-8-6-6. Move that it be passed and moved on to finance. Okay.
Madam Chair, the unallotment bill was passed in 1939, and there's been, quite frankly, little attention paid to the statute in most of those years, other than when there were some periodic unallotments. But in terms of the statute itself, until recently, Madam Chair, just a few points that I would like to make. Protecting the Constitution, in my view, is not a partisan issue. And this is important legislation about the separation of powers in state government. And Article 3 of the Minnesota Constitution declares no department of government shall exercise the powers properly belonging to either of the other departments. This proposal that has been drawn up by the input by a number of legislators and using other states as a guide is intended to restore the balance of powers between the legislative and executive branches. Currently, Minnesota has one of the least restrictive unallotment statutes in the country, and this is our attempt to bring it in line with other states. And I should footnote it, I was talking to other legislators about the unallotment statute. We had opinions that ranged from repealing to becoming very restrictive. And so as I developed this legislation and worked with Senator Cohen on the Senate side, we made decisions to be what I would describe in terms of unallotment within the mainstream of other states. So what we would do under this bill, we would limit unallotment to no more than 2% of the general fund appropriations for a biennium and no more than 10% of a single general fund appropriation. We would limit unallotment to that portion of a projected deficit that was not known at the completion of the last legislative session And we would also...
Excuse me, just if I can just interrupt, someone has a cell phone on, which is what's causing that ferocious feedback. So someone can... Okay, stop, whatever happened. So. Okay, thanks. Go on.
I had one on, but I don't any longer.
Okay.
That's an announcement
right,
that I made
on.
From time to time about cell phones, and yeah. I forgot myself. It prohibits modifications to formulas or eligibility standards. That means that the payments must be reduced proportionately. And to give you a couple of examples, then, the 2% rule would limit allotment to, for you to use the current budget numbers as a standard, $772 million. The examples that I might use where there were changes in formulas and so on, the hours of personal care attendance, for example, the renter's credit, which was reduced from 18% to 15%. So what we would ensure would be essentially a leveler playing field across the state appropriations and the ways in which the legislature had chosen to prioritize those appropriations. Unallotment has been used in the past. Just to give you a few percentages, in 1980 it was 2.6% at one point. April of 86, that was August of 80, April of 86, it was 1.1%. In 2003 it was 1%. In 2009 it was 0.8%. And that was January of 09. In July of 09, we all know that it did exceed the 2% level. But the point being, most of those years, the guidelines in this bill would have worked perfectly well. A majority of states limit the governor's power to one allot in one of three ways. Some limit it to across-the-board cuts only. Some have a maximum percentage reduction. Some require legislative approval. So as you can tell, we've kind of taken a blend with the 2% overall, no more than 10% of a given appropriation, and not changing formulas. Those would be kind of the gist, if you will, of the proposal that you have before you.
Okay.
Oh, and then on this one, I guess the league will be prepared to testify whenever you're ready to take public testimony.
Okay, I guess I just have one question. Is had this been the law at the end of the last legislative session, how would it have changed what the governor did?
What transpired couldn't have happened because, first of all, it has to be... he based his decision on the February forecast.
Okay.
And the bill provides that it would have to be unanticipated at the time of adjournment. The other thing that it would have impacted on, for example, I gave a couple, and there are a couple more I could give, where programs were closed out
right.
in their entirety, so that would have been prevented under this, because you couldn't have gone more than 10% within a given program. If that answers your question, Madam Chair.
Sure. Okay. Any questions, or shall we hear from the League of Women Voters? Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Carlson, I may have missed this while I was reading this and you were explaining it, but can you explain, does this affect both years of the biennium? Or is it just the final year? Or?
The answer, Madam Chair, is yes.
Okay. Okay. We can have your witness now. So,
did you want to go to public testimony?
Yes.
Oh.
State your name before for the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Keisha Gaskins. I'm the Executive Director for the League of Women Voters. Very briefly, the League of Women Voters supports the passage of House File 2866. We understand the need for executive action in times of unanticipated budget shortfall. This legislation provides the framework for future governors to act to resolve budget shortfalls in times of economic crisis. League of Women Voters Minnesota believes the current statute is overly broad and impermissibly vague. We did file an amicus brief in the current case. The broad unallotment power allowed in the current statute makes it possible for the governor to engage in lawmaking with respect to spending levels and priorities in a manner that invades the powers delegated to the legislature. We believe that the limitations in the statute, allowing only proportional payment reductions, elimination of the ability of the commissioner to modify formulas, cap on overall reductions at 2%, inclusion of deferrals of payments within the definition of unallotment, all serve to protect the intent of the legislature during the unallotment process. We believe that the legislation provides specific guidance and limitations to determine how properly enacted legislative appropriations are put into practice, and that will adequately maintain our system of checks and balances.
Okay. Any questions for the witness? Representative Downing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, so historically, and I know growing up as a kid, the League of Women Voters had a very nonpartisan, apartisan reputation, and yet you filed an amicus brief in what was very clearly an intense political legal challenge. And so I'm curious, is that common for the League of Women Voters to file amicus briefs on any issue or to weigh in on political disputes or constitutional disputes? And if so, how does that, how do you as maybe a board reconcile that with the very impartial reputation that you have out there in the political marketplace?
Certainly. Madam Chair? The League of Women Voters does, in fact, persistently weigh in on matters of constitutionality. And because the Constitution is in itself nonpartisan and very consistent with our agenda. And in this case, our amicus brief did not allege, as did some of the arguments, that the particular actions by the governor were unconstitutional, but that the statute itself was overly broad and vague, so it did not rely upon any political or partisan action, but simply that the legislation itself was overly broad and vague.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, do we have fiscal notice, or is this the whole thing, the fiscal process? I guess there's no fiscal note for this. This is essentially a fiscal process that's before us. Are there any last comments, Representative Carlson, or any?
Other than that, I would appreciate the support of the committee and would go, of course, then for further discussion before the full Finance Committee.
Okay. Any other questions of any committee members? Okay. I'll now renew my motion that House File 2866 be recommended to pass and go on to Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Okay. Next one.
You want to take the third one as well?
Sorry, I know we just passed this, but there's no fiscal note, but yet it's going to Finance. Is that correct?
It's
in Finance, and so
it deals with overall fiscal policy is the reason that it's here.
All right.
Okay.
Madam Chair, do you want
to
take
go on to the next
3073
next?
3073. And this should be a short one. This was a bill that was requested by Madam
Chair. I guess I'll move 3073 to pass and go on to Finance.
And Madam Chair, there are two parts to the bill. One deals with the depositing of receipts and the other registration and a charge for combined charities. And I'll just have the department, if it's all right with you, explain the need for the bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Monkwitz from the Minnesota Management and Budget. And as Representative Carlson stated, there's two items in this department bill. The first one involves the deposits that are required to be made by state agencies. Today's law says that on any given day when you have total checks or cash, the total $250, you have to deposit those. This bill is asking to raise that limit to $1,000. And we're asking for this because this issue came to us from the DNR. who has operated state parks throughout the state in fairly remote locations. It's a somewhat of a burden for them to, on a daily basis, have to drive 20 or 30 miles each way to make a deposit of $250. So they've asked for an increase in that limit. We think it's a good idea. The law hasn't been changed in 30 years. In 1981, they raised the limit from $50 to $250, so it's a long time since there's been a change there. The second item is just a clarification of language that is centered around our combined charities campaign that's held every year. There isn't explicit language in the statute today that allows us to deposit the money into the special revenue fund and then expend it for expenses related to the program. So we're just asking for that authority, and that's just a clarification.
Okay. Any quick, Representative Polber?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my years at the legislature over and over again, whether it's in local government or in this committee, when we hear from the state auditor and about risk management, et cetera, we talk a lot about limiting the amount of risk. And I think $1,000 in cash sitting around is a lot of money. And so as this bill moves forward, I wish you would take another look at it in having a limit of so much of cash and then maybe total receipts. In other words, if in fact the issue is that the majority of the receipts in these parks are not cash and you want to wait till there's $1,000 worth of checks there, then I think we should say that. But I don't think that the language should be so broad that if there is an entity that deals mostly in cash, that we sign off on $1,000 worth of cash sitting around. So I think there could be a way to nuance this so that in the case where there is a lot of cash coming into a particular state entity, we keep a lower threshold, a lower level of risk for stealing, et cetera, but allow, in the case of checks, et cetera, for them to accumulate at a higher amount.
Okay. I think I see nods, so I guess I think we're going to look into what the issue is. Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have two concerns here. One of them is you mentioned at the DNR, but this language is for everybody.
Sure.
And there are those that are not in this situation, and I think that what Representative Holberg said is a real concern. My question is, it's in our committee today, and it seems as though there's some nods here that you can, you know, really need to adjust this language. The other thing is I would really like to hear from the legislative auditor as far as I don't want to put you in a situation where we pass this and then there are issues later on and here we've created them. So I think the legislative auditor is an issue, restricting it. I think the cash check situation. Are we going to have an opportunity to amend this along the way here, or what happens now?
Well, it's germane. I think amendments to it are germane in finance, since it's a fiscal area, in ways and means, and on the floor. So I think it is, depending on what the thrust of the amendments are. I think the argument we've heard is that we started at 50, we went to 250 in 81, and it's probably time, just when you're looking at the value of money, to increase it again now, 30 years later. So,
Madam Chair.
Well,
To Representative Kiffmeyer's concerns, we certainly understand where you're coming from the OLA's perspective. We know that there have been some reports of some agencies that haven't safeguarded the deposit, yeah, or they haven't met the requirements of the law that you do have to deposit those when it reaches 250. So we're aware of that, but our policies state that agencies have to safeguard those funds. So whether it's 250 or raised to the $1,000 level, the majority of that would be in checks. You know, so much of the activity of the state now is conducted via electronic, you know, credit cards. So the DNR isn't dealing with a lot of cash or a lot of checks anymore. It's usually via credit cards. But we certainly understand the concern, and nothing is changing the policy that's already in place that says those assets have to be safeguarded before they're made before they reach the bank. So we understand that. And yes, it does lift the limit for all state agencies, but more and more, very few state agencies are dealing with any checks or cash at this time anyway. So we think that it would work across state government.
Actually, I should have also asked you to say something about the second part of the bill.
Madam Chair, I did talk a little bit about that. I can restate it if you'd like.
Yes, I would.
The second part is really just seeking some clarification language. When the original language was put in place, it wasn't explicitly stated that the commissioner had the ability to deposit the funds into a special revenue account and then expend those funds for operating costs for the combined charity campaign. So this is just some clarifying language that we felt we needed in the statute. The total dollars that we're talking about here is in the range of $3,500 to $4,000 each year.
Okay. Representative Kennedy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was thinking about the same concern that Representative Kiffmeyer raised, and then I was reminded, maybe Representative Winkler or Downey can confirm this, but my understanding of the OLA report, specifically on the small agencies with the cash on hand question, was really a question of internal controls and kind of guidance and training and getting you might be tempted to think that we're creating more of an opportunity, but the work that this committee did on a very bipartisan basis last year to address this concern, and hearing from the department that I think that we're really cleaning up those small agencies and providing the guidance from MMB's perspective, so I just wanted to, I'm seeing everyone nod, so for the record, I'm seeing people nod, and if anyone wants to confirm that on the tape, that's great, but I feel much more comfortable seeing people confirm that was indeed the case, so synesthesia here, I'm hearing people nod.
Okay, any further discussion on House File 3073? Okay, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much. That finishes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm sorry, I should have made this announcement at the start of the meeting, but House File 2758, Representative Lilly's bill on the labor agreements and compensation plans, is postponed until next week, next Tuesday. Okay, so if anyone's here only for that, they can go. Representatives, sir. File 2690.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members. I have before you, House File 2690. And
yes.
I actually have two author's amendments to put the bill in the shape that I need it.
Okay. I'll move House File 2690, passed and referred to finance. So we have a...
Madam Chair, this bill deals with some reductions in funding, and in order to be prescriptive with how much savings we can realize, the A2 and the A5 amendments would need to be passed. Okay. And then I can explain the bill in total after that.
We have an A4 and an A5.
Okay. Yeah.
Which?
Both need to be passed to put the bill in check.
Madam Chair, I move the A4 amendment.
Representative Winkler moves the A4 amendment. Okay. We'll just pass these and put the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Then the A5 amendment. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll move that.
Representative Winkler moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor of the A5 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Okay, now the bill is in the form that the author would like. Okay, Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Members, I bring before you a bill that will reduce government and make some cuts in different areas of what I believe is middle management and bureaucracy. Every member of the committee and the public is aware of the overwhelming budget deficit we have and its impact on our economy and jobs. I'm seeing with many of the solutions that are coming forward an incredible impact on working class Minnesotans, be they teachers, firefighters, nurses, and the like. And I just feel that we have to make sure that our priorities are in line with our state budget. And I always feel that it's unfortunate that it seems to be some of the first cuts happen to some of our core government services and some of those folks in the middle class. And I feel a more appropriate place to look at, if we're going to prioritize our state funding, is to look at some of the middle management and bureaucracy in our government. This bill really does four things, members. It first and foremost looks to require the executive branch to reduce some of our out-of-state contracts. The amendment to tighten up that language. We contract for many state services, and that's very important, especially in transportation. We don't have a Department of Roads that goes up and builds the roads. We contract with the private sector to build our roads. But I do feel every year we spend $450 million in out-of-state or in-state contracts, $90 million from the general fund, and many of these are to out-of-state businesses. And I think in these tough economic times, we should prioritize that if we're spending taxpayer dollars, they should be in Minnesota businesses. So this would cut approximately 4.4% out of out-of-state contracts, and that would save roughly $4 million. The second portion of this bill would prohibit out-of-state travel except for in the areas of emergencies, and I believe this language has already been passed in the state government finance portion of Chair Carlson's bill. It would just mirror that language. We wouldn't double book it, but in case something goes wrong, I think it would be good to have this portion moving forward in a separate bill, and that would save roughly $2.3 million. Members, since the governor has mentioned his hiring freeze a few years ago, there's been incredible growth in the number of managerial positions in state government. Over 65 managerial positions have been created or filled since this supposed hiring freeze. We would look at eliminating those 65 positions, and that would save $7 million. And then the fourth area of this bill would reduce the number of assistant commissioners and political appointees, about 25% of them, and that would save roughly another $2 million. And just for an example, members, in the governor's office, he has two deputy chiefs of staff who each make over $100,000 a year. I think in this time when we're looking at layoffs at our schools, in nursing homes, police officers and the like, a chief executive could do with just one deputy chief of staff, realize those savings. And so members, this bill would save approximately $15 million, and that would be $15 million that would not need to be cut in other areas, I believe, of higher priority. And these savings would move forward, and that's what I just want to make this point perfectly clear in the outset. I'm not doing this to be partisan or political. The P word I would use is priorities, members. We will have a new governor and have new people in charge of our state government one way or another next year. And I don't care if they're Democrats or Republicans, they can learn to live with less middle management as well. With that, I'm open for questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer, first.
I believe there are others.
Okay.
No questions.
Representative who? All right. Pepin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Surtis, I appreciate your attempts to save the state money and reduce the size of government. And I'm curious, though, why we're just going after managerial. I noticed on our agenda we also have a bill later to ratify state labor contracts. And I was looking at the amount of money that we are spending on the labor contracts, and it looks to me, if I'm reading this correctly, that we're spending $40 million in additional dollars over the biennium. And so and there's, let's see, AFSCME, MAPE, several others, all of them receiving a pay increase except the Minnesota State University, it looks like to me. And I'm wondering how we would justify making a cut to one area, and when we're in this terrible budget situation, why we would put another $40 million in new spending and labor contracts. And I realize that this isn't your bill, but seeing as how you're the majority leader and seeing as how you're wanting to cut middle managers and whatnot, which I think is an admirable goal, but I'm trying to figure out why we wouldn't be across the board, why we wouldn't all share in this.
Sure.
Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, I think that's a great question. The labor contracts, and we're getting far afield from my bill, but the labor contracts are a negotiated position between the executive branch and those workers. There have been eliminations of jobs in those areas already, and so I'm just trying to bring it more in line where we've seen those sorts of jobs eliminated from some of the budget decisions over the last couple of years, where we've seen the growth in jobs in state government has been in this managerial position. So there has been a decrease in jobs in those areas, the frontline workers, for example, but there's been an increase in the number of positions in this middle management. So I'm just looking to address that.
Madam Chair and Majority Leader, with all due respect, and I understand that these are negotiated contracts, but it's very disappointing to see that there's increases when the rest of the state and the rest of our budget, we have to make such tough choices. And to the extent that you have authority and you have leadership with some of these different groups and they respect your opinion and whatnot, I would hope that you would push to bring contracts in the future more in line with reality.
Madam Chair, and Representative Pepin, the executive branch, the governor's office, is the one that does the negotiations. We in the legislative role, whether my title is majority leader or whatever, we don't have any authority in that area.
And I'll point out that in our bill, our cuts that we have made following the governor's recommendation of 3% and so forth are very likely to hit those areas of employment. That's this general philosophy of the reduction of when facing budget cuts, how positions get released, and it's called kind of the cup of coffee philosophy, that people tend not to fire the people that they drink coffee with each day. And so the firing tends to occur at the bottom. And in previous years when we've done this, we've sometimes made a requirement, we've put a requirement in looking at budget reductions through cutting down employment, that the cuts be proportional along the, going down from the top of the pyramid down to the bottom of the pyramid. We didn't do that in this. We didn't do that in our budget bill this year, and this is probably an attempt to make sure that some of the cuts occur with the people who are having coffee with the people who are making the cuts. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Sertich. I see that you're not including Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and this language just talks about state agencies. What does that mean for constitutional officers? Is that just what's addressed in the state government portion of the bill, or why is it just agencies here?
Madam Chair and Representative Pepin, the state agencies were addressed in the state government finance bill, so I'm looking to mostly address the state agencies. So, and MNSCU has their own board that is selected and make a lot of those budget decisions themselves, so I leave them separate, much as we can't really control University of Minnesota as well.
Madam Chair, refresh my memory because I don't have it in front of me. Didn't we make cuts to state agencies in our budget?
We made cuts to state agencies, and we also made cuts to the constitutional offices. That was that general 3% cut that we made. But they were only to the ones in our division, so we didn't do MNSCU or anything like that. And we didn't do. We had talked. At some point, we had talked about doing some of these cuts across the top, but we didn't. Again, we didn't do it because of the theory that was being done in the different divisions. Some of that was being done in different divisions, and it was too difficult to do it without double counting.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bingham.
For the last three years, soon to be four, I've been on the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and I'm sure that Mr. Hubinger and Representative Lilly will come in and testify to this, and Majority Leader Sertich is right. This is getting kind of far out of the scope of his bill, but first off, the negotiations that do occur between the governor's office and the bargaining units, any agreements come out of the base salary or base money that each of the departments have, and so there actually is, they have to come up with that increase through their base. Also, when it relates to the constitutional officers and the deputy commissioners and such, they all have their own individual plans that are negotiated between the governor's office and the representatives from those units. So it's putting a little bit of put it into context a little bit, and I'm sure that when Representative Lilly comes up to talk about the ratification of the contracts, can ask some more questions, but that's just trying to help.
Madam Chair?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Oh, excuse me.
We're going down a list. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this is a very good kind of bill, so I think this is just great. But I do think that when you're dealing with one constitutional officer, you should definitely deal with all of them. Because I think, you know, if the principle carries through, then it might be fair to look at the other constitutional officers as well. And so are you open to that?
I know. Well, Representative Sir.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the other constitutional officers are addressed in the big budget balancing bill. What I'm primarily trying to get after is state agencies and then political appointees. So that is the impetus of this bill.
The other ones have very distinct allowed personnel in their budgets. So I think we'd...
Well, Madam Chair, okay. And Representative Sertich, I think those other constitutional officers also have directors of government relations and also have, you know, I think the deputy thing has generally been, so I think the positions you may do would be a little bit different, but I think the principle of what you're talking about here, I think, is still validly applied. And so, but you're saying no to the other constitutional officers? You don't want to do the same principle to them as well? And by the way, the 3% went to agencies, the 3% went to everybody else, so this is an addition to that 3%, so I just think it would be fair to look at it that way.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, you're certainly more than happy to bring forward ideas like that. I'm, like I said, focusing on the state agencies primarily.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand that where your focus is right now and the purpose of the committee is to have these kinds of discussions. So certainly that is something that I think we should take this point and do that, and maybe I can work with you to maybe do a subdivision 3 that would be appropriate.
Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I'd be open to looking at any additions you'd have to finding cost savings that wouldn't negatively impact those offices.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I just had one other kind of a practical question. And again, there was an amendment to this that changed the language, so it changes things a little bit. But this has to do with, I think it's Section 2 in the original bill, Section 4 in the amendment. And this has to do with professional and technical contracts. And in particular, it says here that to the extent possible, professional and technical contracts, but if they can't do it, then it's a cut to the agencies. Am I reading that correctly here? And just want to be sure we have a fiscal understanding of what this does to, because we have a 3% cut to agencies, and then we have other things, and some of it are backfilled, and now we have another reduction here. So I just want to be sure we have a fiscal understanding of the impact of this language.
To be here in the amendment.
Maybe staff can explain that.
Madam Chair and members, yes, in the amendment A4 on line 1.12 and continuing down, you'll see that it says the Commissioner of Management and Budget will allocate a reduction of $4 million among the general fund appropriations for fiscal year 2011, and then to the extent possible, this has to be achieved through expenditures for professional and technical contracts. But just to be clear, that is that the only way to achieve savings is to actually reduce agency appropriations. And so this would be a reduction with the direction to try to achieve it through professional and technical contracts.
This is similar to the language that we, in our bill, we did not specify this amount, and we had this run-on sentence which included professional and technical expenses, but at the end of that, of what we said they should have tried to do by efficiencies, we then had this line that says that the head of MMB can then just cut the budgets if they haven't achieved it.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I
because
do.
That's the only way you can book the cut.
Yes. I just wanted to be sure, though, that as we do these multiple successive kinds of times, the percentages change and those numbers kind of change. I just want to be sure. The other thing is just a comment that on professional technical contracts, it was interesting over the years between 2000 and 2006 that There was one time where we had a shortage of professional technical people who could do it, and the prices were skyrocketing. And then about 4 years later, the prices of this kind of professional services went down, and it's a temporary kind of situation, not a permanent. So I just want to be sure that we don't hamper the ability of the other directives that we give to agencies to do their work. But nonetheless, I think that answers my question for now. I think I would rather work on the other savings instead. Okay.
Representative Dunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sertich, I too actually like this bill quite a lot. I think maybe it's overly surgical on naming some of the positions, but in general, going after the targeted group level of employment that you are is probably the right one. I mean, as you deploy technologies and automate functions and things, the need for all that middle level management goes down. So I think there's some real merit here. I have a question about the a possible inconsistency with the Carlson, the 2866 bill, and in unallotment, it appears that the unallotment authority, even as redefined, talks about single general fund appropriations and targeted very specifically to program lines in the budget, I assume, not knowing this area of law very well. And yet your bill seems to not only imply but kind of require that an agency take its unallotment and apportion it kind of generally across the agency. And so I'm wondering if it may just be tightening up the language or reconciling this a little better. But my understanding from the Carlson bill is that these unallotments would occur in a pretty surgical way towards specific program line items. And then here in this bill, we're asking the agency to somehow take that unallotment and spread it across the agency, which seems to be slightly inconsistent. So maybe just it's a question, and if there's not a great answer, whatever, just... Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, I did want to provide flexibility to the state agencies and the executive branch. You need to be surgical in some areas, like the governor's office, because you have to name positions. But in areas of assistant commissioners and those sort of job titles, these are folks also like our state economists. We're not going to get rid of our state economists, but we certainly want to provide some flexibility to make sure that these agencies across the board and the governor can kind of balance which ones are more necessary in these times and which ones we can do without.
Madam Chair.
Right. Okay. Representative Downey.
So I might have confused multiple topics there. I was my actual question was whether or not the assumption in your bill about the agency had being able to spread the unallotments kind of across all of the program areas in that department, when in fact the unallotments would be very focused towards a specific program within that department, if that's maybe not an area that needs to be reconciled and tightened up, or you could offer a comment to that.
Sure. And Madam Chair, Representative Downey, that is the way you can realize the savings. I'm certainly hopeful that, for example, within the area of out-of-state contracts, like I said, it's 4% of $90 million. I'm hopeful they can find that so they don't have to resort to the next step of spreading out the cut. I hope that they stick to the letter of what we're trying to do and don't step around that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Sertich. Maybe I can just hit you up offline because I'm not sure I've conveyed my question accurately. A second question, and I might offer a potentially friendly amendment here. So one of the reasons agencies use temporary employment, obviously, is because it's a short-term burst of activity or a highly specialized activity where they don't have the skills in-house. And while it's expensive on an hourly basis or on a FTE basis for that year or two that they have the staff, overall it's a good decision because you don't take on a new position or new employee for 20 or 30 years. And so I'm curious. I can just see the reaction in the agencies where if I have to find collectively $4 million of savings, and maybe that's 40 contractors per year if you kind of just do some rough math, that they might be tempted to hire 40 full-time people who are half as expensive, at least in this year, to realize the savings, and yet we've created a 20 or 30-year liability of fully loaded salary and benefits. So my friendly amendment, if I could offer it, Madam Chair, is this an appropriate time, would be on line 1.17
of the bill or the amendment?
Hold on, I better make sure. It's the A4 amendment.
Okay.
On line 1.17, between the word contracts and the comma, insert the language without hiring permanent staff replacements. So that whole sentence beginning on line 1.15 would read, to the extent possible, this reduction must be achieved through reductions in expenditures for professional and technical contracts without hiring permanent staff replacements, comma.
Is that?
I'll offer it as an amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
seems to be acceptable to the author.
I'd accept that, yeah.
Okay. All those in favor of the Downing amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Any other?
Madam Chair, a quick question. Yeah. I know we're running out of time, but Representative Sertich, sorry, is going to, is a slip of the tongue.
I'm getting more love on this side of the table than that side of the table.
Well, I actually think I'm an author on this bill, and I like it quite a bit for the reasons that the other side has stated and that you did. But I just want to understand with Representative Carlson here as well that that what this bill would do would actually go beyond the target that this committee has set and is in
yes.
a bill that was incorporated in finance. So the budget target, that a resolution that I think was approved last night, is $1 million cut to the Department of Education and $155 million to Health and Human Services, you know, to nursing homes and the disability waiver programs, et cetera. So the savings through political appointees and efficiencies that you've identified in this bill beyond what our committee bill is incorporated would actually reduce the need to cut in, for instance, Health and Human Services. Do I have that right? And
yes.
Madam Chair and Representative Kennan, that's exactly the point. We are cutting deeper in these areas to maintain jobs, Minnesota jobs, and key priorities in the areas of health care and education and others, yes.
Well, Madam Chair, I think then given the budget resolution adopted in Ways and Means last night, this is a no-brainer.
Okay, Representative Hobart. We do have a couple of more bills on the agenda. The one that I really want to get to is Representative Swales, because I think there are people from out of state, and also the auditor is here, who can tell us about what she does for government relations and so forth.
Mr. Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative
Is there a fiscal note for this bill? I don't see a fiscal note. So we've had all this discussion, and this is the Finance Committee that's supposed to make these decisions, so...
Madam Chair and Representative Holbert, I'll take the first swing before our fiscal staff does. In the original language, it wasn't as prescriptive, and that's why I did the author's amendment, so you can actually realize the savings. If you add it up, it's roughly $15 million in savings, but I'm sure now with the amendments that are offered, we'll probably get a fiscal note now that there are prescriptive numbers in there. Did I get that right, I hope, or close?
Yeah, that's correct.
Ms. Babbitt. Yes.
Madam Chair, I did not request a fiscal note on the original bill because it merely gave direction in terms of if future reductions were made, how those should be allocated. With the amendments, I will request a fiscal note because there would then be some specific savings identified.
And just real quickly, as a matter of a policy, when I first looked at your list, I thought maybe these were the people that took you off their Christmas card list. my question, and I think this reflects a real frustration with the private sector, is in virtually every sector of our economy, if people are still working, and I say that with a big if, they've taken wage reductions, taken on more work, unpaid furloughs, reduction in benefits, I mean, you name it, it's happening out in the private sector just to keep as many people working as possible. Why would you not set a goal rather than wholesale elimination of all these jobs if, in fact, there was a way to keep people on at 0.8 or what? I mean, you can realize a lot of savings. It puts a little bit of hurt in a lot of families' budget. And quite frankly, that's been, in my opinion, the prevailing approach in the private sector. Why would you choose this approach where you will decimate the family budget of the people that hold these positions.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, it goes to your first point about actually realizing the savings. The only way to actually be able to book and realize the savings, to save the other jobs that I spoke of, is to be prescriptive. And that's what's happening in other areas. Once the money goes out the door from the state to our education systems, they are laying off people fully. Once the nursing homes get their funding, they try their best, but layoffs do happen. The only way we can actually book and realize the savings if we're prescriptive and say, you must lay off these people. Because other than that, we don't get a fiscal note, we can't realize the savings, book it to make sure we can save the other jobs.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Sertich, why couldn't you prescribe a certain dollar reduction in staff costs within the executive branch, for example?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, yeah. I'm open to looking at that. The one that just jumped out, as I said before, and got me was having two deputy chiefs of staff. I mean, it just makes sense to me that maybe we can encourage legislatively that you get rid of one of them. I'm open, if there's another way of doing it, I'd be happy to sit down. It'd be my first time sitting down with the governor this year, but I'd be happy to sit down, and I don't want to get too much into his business, but if he finds a better way to realize the savings, I'm more than happy to work with him on the way through this bill.
I'd really like to move this one on so we can really try and do the swales bill at the same time. Okay. Any
Representative Madam Chair, just in regards to that, am I assuming this goes to Finance Committee and
yes,
then
it always
the Finance
does.
Committee to the floor?
To Ways and Means.
Ways and Means.
Ways and Means?
Yes.
That's the track?
Yes.
All right, thanks.
Okay, all those in favor of the motion to pass the bill as amended on to Finance, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion passed.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Sales. Swales. This is the one last bill that we're going to do today. Again, sorry for overscheduling, but what happens at this time? Representative Swales and McFarland, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have an amendment, if you would move that, please. It's A10-238.
House File 2840, and it's the A10 amendment. Okay, let me move the bill. I'll move House File 2840, pass and go on to Finance. Okay. And now I'll also move the A10 amendment.
Thank you, Chair.
In fact, let's put the A10 amendment on to have the bill in the way the author would like it. Those in favor of the A10 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly before we explain the amendment, I just want to give a quick overview of what this bill is. It's the establishment of what we call a collaborative governance council, and it's the result of a year's worth of work. Representative McFarland and I have traveled the state over the summer and into the fall, visiting 5 of the 8 service cooperatives that were established back in the 1970s that actually do a lot of collaborative work with school districts, particularly in greater Minnesota. The concern when we took this bill to Representative Pulaski's committee was at that time it had a fiscal note on it. We've been working very hard in the time between that committee and this to remove that fiscal note with this amendment. And if you don't mind, Madam Chair, Representative McFarland will explain what the amendment does.
Okay. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be very brief, since that committee and the meeting with the state auditor, we amended a few things. First of all, to take out the fiscal note, we added or changed the expiration and effective dates, and we tightened up the language.
So we have
So, Madam Chair, real quickly, just so you know, as we traveled the state and we talked to hundreds of stakeholders and visited with superintendents, county, city, and township people, we kept asking the same question over and over again, and that is, what are the obstacles that keep schools, counties, cities, and towns from sharing services or collaborating? And throughout those many miles and those many months, there were 5 things that came up as regular themes, and that is that we have statutes, rules, and laws that impede collaboration. There is a lack of efficiency in delivering governmental services. There's a lack of broadband access across the state that inhibits efficient collaboration. There are outdated systems that are unable to better process financial transactions. And for many smaller communities, it's just simply the cost of attorney's fees to create joint powers agreements that are very, very costly. So at this point, Madam Chair, I would like to invite State Auditor Rebecca Otto to comment on the bill.
Okay. I've been actually asked to put one more amendment on, so I'd like to check if that's okay with the author. We would change the number of members on the council to 13, and we would add a member of MAPE. Is that acceptable to the authors? One said yes and one said no. Representative Swales.
Madam Chair, at this point, we have not had time to digest that. The people that are listed on the council are the ones that responded to the public meeting notices that we had. We were just contacted by MAPE, and we're certainly willing to talk with them, and we just need more time to process.
Okay, well, there's no reason why that couldn't be moved in finance, so I'll withdraw it at this time. Okay.
Madam Chair, members, Rebecca Otto, the State Auditor. This is a great bill. I think in tight times when government is trying to make do with what they have, and sometimes there's an increased demand. You know, I know there's collaboration and cooperation going on right now. I know there's been efficiencies that have been built in. but I think we have to continue to work in government to figure out if there's anything more we can do, and if there's anything the legislature can do. And I currently have a process set up with the firefighters in the state of Minnesota, the fire relief associations, the pension funds. And we have city representatives on the working group. We keep it small, but we bring in experts when we need to. And we've been able to change lots of laws around their pensions that make the pension process easier and more effective and hopefully more successful. So using that same model, which this would pretty much mirror, it brings the people to the table that are affected, and then we look to see if we can find things that we can all agree upon in terms of changes in statutes or things that would be beneficial to all local governments, and then it helps the legislature then change statute around that if necessary.
Okay. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, all three of you, for your work on this. I just have one question. Are you going to, there's a report due. And I'm wondering, it says a whole bunch of chairs and stuff, and that's cool. I'm just wondering, are you going to put this on your website, or are you going to have this an electronic version for people like at local governments also could take a look at it?
Madam Chair and Representative Bingham, I frankly, what we're going to try to do is come up with some legislation to propose to you. Okay, and so we're hoping that it's going to be something that can be implemented, that everyone's agreed upon at the table, that we can bring to you that actually creates change quickly, and or recommendations that they're long-term, we can provide a report. But we would try to make that accessible, and we would report to legislators, and I think currently there's already information will be sent to folks, and I'm happy to try to make it as transparent as possible, so that's my job.
Okay, I think you see that we deleted some of the specific report to get rid of the fiscal note. You look at the amendment, so it's kind of going to be up to them to, without those requirements, to see what they can do.
And Madam Chair, I do know that we are very short on time, but many of the stakeholders who have worked diligently, this was a collaboratively written bill. They are sitting behind me, and I would like to acknowledge that.
Okay. Is there any question that, and the stakeholders are the people listed on this list, is there any question that any member of the committee would ask of, on my apologies for overscheduling, would like to ask of any of the particular people on this list? Okay, we believe that you worked hard, and we're thankful that you did it, and we trust in the synopsis we've heard from the authors.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other discussion of this bill?
Madam Chair, I do want to know the path. Is this then going to be referred to?
It goes back to, it goes to finance, and then supposedly maybe not. If it has no fiscal note, maybe then it goes right to the floor from there without going to Ways and Means.
That would be our purpose.
I haven't figured that out yet, but someone at the next step will know. We know we send it to finance. Okay. Any further discussion? Oh, it doesn't seem to. Okay. Okay. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Meeting adjourned. We're going to meet again Tuesday at a time to be determined. But it will probably be before session, which is at 12:30.